Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz and joined as always by Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, as usual, Iran is at the forefront of our agenda, right? There's a lot to talk about this week, and we get into a lot of it with our two interviewees, Annie Ehrenheim, the Jerusalem Post military correspondent, who we'll talk to a bit later about Israeli plans for a possible strike one day against Iran, but also with Yiftach Curiel, a veteran diplomat who serves as the director of digital diplomacy at the MFA, the Ministry for Foreign Affairs. But I wanted to throw a theory by you and see what you think, right?
All right.
I think that the part of Israel's concern about Iran is, and the deal that might be done or made by the P5 plus one, and including the United States, is also, of course, about the fact that there will be a bad deal. But it also has to do with this larger trend, which is America's withdrawing from the region. We saw that with Afghanistan. We saw that during the Trump period. We saw that during the Obama period. And we're seeing that continuing with Biden. And part of this deal is make a deal, get out, and forget about it. Right. And I think that has Israel very concerned.
Yeah, I think so, because Israel does not have good options if that happens. I mean, we saw this week the National Security Advisor of the United Arab Emirates went to Tehran to meet with his Iranian counterpart. For them, they are not the sworn mortal enemies of the Islamic Republic. They can, you know, make up and make amends and try to have better relations with Iran if they think that America is not going to protect them. And that seems to be what they're doing. We don't have that option. You know, we're the little Satan and America is the big Satan, and Iran does not want to be our friend, even if we tried. And I mean, you know, in our interview with Annie, it gets pretty bleak. But I have to say that, like, yeah, the U.S. withdrawing from the Middle East is bad news for Israel. You know, our leaders always say we have to be able to defend ourselves by ourselves. But it's a lot easier and a lot more plausible with friends.
Right. And if we look at what's happening, right, and especially if we take the Afghanistan model, right, Biden pulls out of Afghanistan. The consequences are dire. The Taliban immediately take over, but who cares, right? We're out. America's out. So they don't have to worry about it anymore. And the same could happen here very quickly. As a deal is made with Iran, it gives 10 years of quiet. Okay, America can say, we're good. Now we can leave, right? But we stick by our promise. They'll never get a nuclear weapon. Now, Israel's issue with that, right, is, and you've written about this too, is that Israel has a different timeline. It doesn't look at the getting the weapon necessarily. It doesn't want Iran to be a nuclear threshold state.
Right. You know, you look at the way Iran is behaving right now, and it uses its nuclear program as leverage. I mean, even while talks were taking place in Vienna last week, and they're supposed to be renewed at the end of this week, they were advancing their nuclear program further, you know, taking more, using advanced centrifuges in Karaj, which is new, and they're using it to toughen their stance in negotiations. And so for Israel, that's a problem in two ways. Number one, that the world sort of has less of a way to limit their nuclear program. And number two, Iran is just that much closer to being able to attack Israel, you know, in a much worse way than before.
What's your take on the government, right? You have Bennett and Lapid. Herzog is kind of playing a pinch hitter. He's always there in the background helping with the messaging. Do you get a feeling that Bennett and Lapid know what they're doing? They're working correctly. They're working together.
I think that they wanted to try something different. They were hopeful that they could work in cooperation with the Biden administration and that it would work out the way that they want it to, and that the Biden administration would be tough on Iran if they kept their disagreements sort of behind doors and just, you know, embraced each other publicly. And it didn't work. I don't think that it was a bad idea to try it, because, you know, when Netanyahu had his huge fight with the Obama administration, it didn't stop them from signing the bad agreement with Iran. You know, on the plus side, it got us allies in the UAE and Bahrain. But, you know, he didn't accomplish what he set out to accomplish. So it made sense for this government to try a different approach. But that approach hasn't worked for them either. And so now they've gone back to, you know, saying what they really think out in the open. You know, and I think that there's actually a lot of sympathy for Israel in London and Paris right now, I think that you act weirdly, really, you see more concern about Iran and harsher language about Iran coming from Europe than from the United States right now. But the United States is they're sort of the leaders. They might not be in the same negotiating room as Iran because Iran refuses to sit with the Americans, but the Europeans are still taking the Americans' cues. And so it's a really tricky situation.
Tricky situation it is. And while we're speaking, Israel is hosting today the Cypriot leader, right, and the Greek leader.
Yes.
This is a new kind of diplomatic front to position against the Turks. What does this have to do with the way the region is realigning?
Yeah, I mean, I think at different times and different people in the government may agree or not agree about what you said about the Turks, but this is the eighth time that there's been a meeting between the leaders of all three countries. It's the first time it's been Bennett. And this has been going on for about the past 5 years or so. Now, the public focus usually was all about natural gas, cooperating on getting natural gas, on the East Med pipeline, which is a pipeline that has not even begun to be constructed yet, but in theory would be from Israel to the EU for natural gas through Cyprus and Greece. But at the same time, it sends a very strong message to Turkey, which has had, you know, very high tensions with Israel for more than a decade. And of course, is the historic adversary of Greece and in the same way, Cyprus. So the situation between Israel and Turkey right now is I would say it's in a little bit of a strange place. You know, Erdogan hasn't stopped being an anti-Semite or a supporter of Hamas. But at the same time, he keeps making these like little statements of like, oh, I'd like to have better relations with Israel, you know, and a few weeks ago, when that Israeli couple was arrested for taking a picture of Erdogan's palace in Istanbul, and then they were released, it seemed very clear that Erdogan is going to try to leverage his quote unquote kindness to this couple to try to improve ties with Israel. And I think it's mainly for economic reasons.
Kindness for releasing people who didn't do anything. That's true.
Yes, that's generosity. Why I said quote unquote. I think Turkey's in not a good position right now. It has really isolated itself just with its like bad attitude in a lot of ways. But when it comes to Greece and Cyprus, he's actually, you know, done very aggressive things. Not just, I don't know, like in the case of France, where he's just extremely rude to France.
Is Israel doing anything to help that reconciliation with Turkey, right? Beyond the comments that Erdogan has made, is Israel taking practical steps?
I don't see Israel taking practical steps. I actually, and you know, the things Erdogan's been saying has been going on for like a year and a half or so. I think that in Jerusalem, everyone's very wary. You know, they don't trust Erdogan. They don't want like hostility. But on the other hand, like Greece and Cyprus are at the moment much better friends to Israel. And so there's no reason to not continue sort of emphasizing that sort of trilateral relationship.
Right. At the same time, you know, there was that terrorist attack over the weekend on Saturday, which kind of ties into the interview we do with Yiftach Kuriel, the head of the digital diplomacy department at the foreign ministry, because they were the ones who tweeted out the entire video, which shows this terrorist walking down a street near the Damascus Gate outside the old city of Jerusalem, suddenly turns around when he sees an ultra-Orthodox Haredi man behind him, starts to wildly stab him. And then what happens is the two border policemen who he runs towards also to try to attack them.
One was a woman.
Well, men is the...
Yes. Anyway, yes.
Policemen include police women also, I guess, no? Or is that no longer politically correct?
I don't know. But it's unusual.
Okay, so one anyway, border yeah. policeman, one border police woman, right, runs towards them. And they open fire. They shoot him. He falls to the ground. And he starts to continue to move potentially towards them. And they shoot him again, and that's the end of it. And there was actually some criticism, Lahav, as we all know, that came out that maybe that second round of shooting was inappropriate or was not legitimate, right? And people jumped to make comparisons right away to the famous case of Elor Azaria, the soldier who back in 2016 came to the scene of a terrorist attack in Hebron after a terrorist had already been neutralized, had been shot, was lying on the ground. He came 11 minutes later and then shot the terrorist and killed him. And he was actually put on trial, sentenced, went to jail for a bit of time. this is incomparable, right?
Yeah.
And this is, it was upsetting to me to see people making these comparisons because Elora Azaria came 11 minutes later. This was seconds as it was happening. This was in the fog of the battle. This was as it was going on. Not a fair comparison.
Yeah, and if you watch the video, you also see him trying to get up like multiple times and trying to attack the border policeman. So I really do agree with you that it's a completely different case, not only because it happened so fast, but because he was just not giving up and continually trying to attack. But what I also want to talk about in the context of this terrorist attack, you know, there was another one this week where a 15-year-old boy took his father's car and tried to run over Israeli security at a checkpoint in the West Bank. And there have been five different terrorist attacks in, I believe it's the past 2.5 weeks. And so I think we have to ask the question, are we in a new wave of terror? I mean, that is a frequency of terrorist attacks that we haven't seen in a long time. And what I've seen a lot of analysts say is that these are all kind of, or almost all, what are quote unquote lone wolf attacks. Like, yes, there's definitely an environment of incitement against Israel in the Palestinian Authority, but none of these seem to be attacks that are planned by the major organizations, which makes them a lot more challenging to stop.
Right. But we remember, I mean, go back to the 2015, what became known as the stabbing intifada, right? When also these were lone wolf attacks and they were carried out by individuals. They weren't being coordinated by a larger infrastructure organization and they're extremely difficult. But what happens is even if they're not coordinated, one inspires the other, right? And that's the problem. And that's what makes it difficult. I would say that there's probably a bunch of catalysts behind this. One is obviously incitement that continues from the Palestinian Authority. There's incitement from Hamas still about Jerusalem specifically. But there's also the fact that there really is no diplomatic horizon right now. And I'm not saying this to blame Israel. I think most of the blame goes to the Palestinian Authority and the fact that Abu Mazen is still the most intransigent leader they will possibly have. That's a tough competition with Arafat, who was definitely a terrorist, but Abu Mazen does not want to enter into a serious dialogue with Israel. And therefore, that leads to also this uptick in violence, I think.
I mean, I don't know that negotiations means there's no violence. As soon after Oslo, the bus bombings began, you know, when Ehud Barak...
Not negotiations, a dialogue, a horizon of a better future.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I don't think that Abbas is looking to spark like an intifada. I think that he is a... I don't know if conservative is the right word, but he's not generally looking for that per se. But I don't know. It's hard for me to say that the beginning of negotiations or the beginning of a horizon, is that what the average Palestinian wants? You know, when we look at polling, it may be interesting in a future episode to bring someone who like polls Palestinians or Israeli Arabs even about these kinds of issues. You know, I think that Israel has been in this situation with the Palestinians since 1967, right? And the status quo is not good for Palestinians. We can argue all we want, you know, about how they're among the most, you know, educated population groups in the Middle East, et cetera. But, you know, they do want some sort of solution instead of this continued limbo. So in that way, I get what you're saying.
Right. I want to get your thoughts just before we go to our interviews on the situation that continues with COVID, right? Israel is still not letting tourists in. It's still requiring, because of Omicron, it's still requiring that 3-day quarantine when people enter the country. That might change in the coming days because they have to decide whether they're going to extend the restrictions or not. But there's one big win this week for pregnant women. Right. Olim Chadashim or Olot Chadashot from around the world who are pregnant, expecting and want to have their parents come to Israel. The Interior Minister, Ayelet Shaked, has decided together with the Health Ministry to allow those women's parents to enter the country. This came after a video was put together that...
The video is so great. So
Yeah, why don't you tell us about the video?
Yeah, this week, the Miss Universe competition, I think it's this week, is taking place in Eilat. And you have all these beauty queens touring Israel and lots of videos on social media and stuff. So some of these pregnant women made videos that said, "My mom is beautiful too, let her into the country," which I thought was hilarious. But I really feel for these people, you know, in this... episode, we talked to Anna Ehrenheim, who's our defense reporter, but she wrote like a personal article this week about her own experience getting married and then having a child during COVID and not having her family around her. And that's unimaginably hard and just like sad. So I'm glad that the government changed its mind and decided to allow these women, you know, to have their parents come in one of the important moments of their lives.
Yeah. And I think that that's part of the problem with all this COVID is the difficulty in setting clear policy. Is it's always changing. It's fluid. It's unclear. There's rules that are made that restrict everyone. And sometimes you do have to have compassion.
And we're sometimes like the strictest, you know, like we're not the strictest on everything. And I like also just think like the way the population behaves is very different than, I don't know, when I was in New York, like a lot of people were really, really strict and like scared. But, you know, the fact that like we're not letting any foreigners into the country and there's only like two or three other countries in the world who are doing the same thing, maybe a few more than that, but really very few. It's a little bit ridiculous. It's like, you know, I understand the sanctity of life and we don't want the disease to spread, but it has been, you know, basically it's been 2 years now since COVID first started in China, at least. And we need to figure out how to live our lives, and like just constantly closing the country is not going to work. So, you know, I think that this government came in with a promise of not taking such extreme steps, and they need to keep that promise and come up with something else.
On that note, and let's hope they listen to you, Lahav, our first interview was with Yiftach Kuriel, the director of digital diplomacy at Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
On this week's podcast, we have Yiftach Kuriel, the head of digital diplomacy in Israel's foreign ministry, also the former spokesman of the embassy in London, somebody who really has his finger on the pulse of sort of how to brand and market something online, in this case, the state of Israel. And also, you know, we all love to hear, people love to talk about Israel's PR. So this is really an expert. So Yiftach, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, first of all, I think Israel has a really lively social media presence, which is, of course, social media is a phenomenon of the last 15 years or so. So, and you've been around for a lot of the sort of the developing of that. So could you tell us sort of what the strategy is, or what Israel's trying to do by having like such a fun Twitter presence, for example, that's like, you know, joking all the time?
Sure. Well, we have quite a diverse presence online, both from headquarters in Jerusalem and across the world. In fact, we're one of the foreign ministries that's leading the world in the use of social media in diplomacy, in what's called today digital diplomacy. You know, the traditional role of the diplomat has always been to know intimately the metaphor, the 1,000 most important people in the country where he's serving. Right, that's his advantage over anybody else that's sitting in Israel, that he knows people intimately and can advance the interests of the state of Israel. And through social media, we do that. It's a force multiplier. So every diplomat that is creating a community around people who are interested in Israel, in all of the countries where our diplomats are serving, can get to know 20,000, 30,000, 50,000 people that then add up to the network that we operate from headquarters. So we run on 6 platforms, including TikTok and Twitter and Instagram and Telegram. We run in 6 languages from headquarters, including Arabic and Persian, for example. And we have over 350 diplomats across the world who are professionally active on Twitter. So it's one of the most massive presences of any foreign ministry, I think, in the world. And we use that both on the day-to-day to create interest in Israel, and of course, in times of conflict, in order to get our messages across effectively.
So does that also mean, Yiftach, that when a diplomat goes out, right, so a diplomat goes through the cadets course and is trained at the foreign ministry to serve as a diplomat on behalf of the state of Israel around the world, they get trained, you know,
like you said, in identifying who are the key people they need to be in touch with and interacting with foreign governments, wherever they'll be stationed. Is there also a course for how they're supposed to manage social media, wherever they might be, if it's the Ivory Coast, if it's Australia, or if it's the United States?
Yeah, of course. My department, it's quite a big department. Over 30 people now are working at the digital department here at the ministry. It does both the operational, but also, and not less importantly, the training. And the cadet corps are getting about 12 hours of social media training from us. We are opening Twitter accounts for them on the first or second week after they've joined, after they started the course. And we assist them in operating those accounts as the course goes by. So when they go out, they are already, you know, quite adept at using social media. And, you know, if in the past the use of Twitter was seen as a sort of something that you do on the side in addition to your real job as a diplomat, today it's absolutely crystal clear from the level of our management down to the cadets that social media is diplomacy. It's part of the job. And if you have an event or you are undertaking some action and it doesn't have a digital aspect to it, you probably didn't do your job correctly. So we are in a really good place today as far as that's concerned. And we operate on digital on the full spectrum of the ministry's activities. From soft power, you know, Miss Universe in Elat, to the Iranian nuclear program and negotiations that are going on. So we are involved in quite a bit of activity.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of criticism, right? I find that people talk to me, like readers, you know, people who follow me on social media, who are like, why does Israel have such bad PR? Now, personally, I love the @Israel Twitter account. I think it's hilarious and it like shows a really fun side of Israel. But, you know, there are always weaknesses, especially in times of crisis, you know, where sometimes it seems like we're a little slow getting the message across, or it. And so what do you respond to people who think that Israel has a big PR problem?
Again, I think that our social media presence online, if you compare it to certainly to any other foreign ministry, but also to other bodies within the Israeli system, I don't think there is anything comparable. We certainly have a numbers issue. That is to say, there are more people online who don't like Israel and who are happy to post, you know, fake news or half lies or whatever. And we are dealing with that. There is a lot of incitement. There's a lot of anti-Semitism. We are trying to deal with that in many different ways. But I think we are definitely reacting very quickly. I think the coordination between the ministry and Dover Tzal and the IDF is better than it ever was. So things are, I think, are improving, but we have to remember it's a landscape that's constantly changing. So our Twitter presence today is quite massive. We have millions of followers. But it turned out that TikTok was the main site of incitement and fake news during you know, the last confrontation in Gaza and in Israel. And so we did have a TikTok presence, but it was a relatively new one. So, you know, we try to keep up with development, but still, as a big organization, that's always going to be a challenge.
But I just wanted to say just a positive example, I think, is, you know, this horrible stabbing that took place right outside Jerusalem's old city by the Damascus Gate. There was a taxi driver who drove by, or at least it appeared to be, this video coming out of his car. And the video, it looked just like Israel was just shooting about, you know, Israeli police officers were shooting a Palestinian who was lying down on the ground. And then I think it was within about 2 hours, the foreign ministry put online video that showed the full context that this man had stabbed a Haredi man and then ran and tried to attack an Israeli police officer. And then the Israeli police shot him, which I have to say, like 2 hours is very fast. But you, to add to the point that you had made, like, yes, like sometimes, you know, the lie gets out there before the government can get out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And but we've shortened these response times very, very much. It used to be much more difficult, and today we are quite fast. You know, we had to change the diskette, as they say in Hebrew, because as diplomats, you are always told and you're always taught never to make a mistake, check everything 20 times because it's not you, it's the state of Israel that you're representing, and all of that. And we are literally doing the opposite. Timing, relevance, being fast is more important sometimes than being 100% right. You got to do both, but you also have to accept that mistakes will be made. Just like, you know, in your business, when you print newspapers, you're going to make mistakes and you need to do the damage control.
We never make mistakes, Yiftach. I just want to correct you. The Jerusalem Post never makes mistakes.
So we do that. And it's also about letting people know that they're not going to be fired if they make a mistake, and that, right, you know, they are allowing them the possibility to make a mistake. So it was a big challenge to do that, to make that shift.
First of all, I couldn't agree with you more. I always tell people there's no such thing as a newspaper that doesn't have a mistake. When you're publishing so much and printing and writing so much content on a daily basis, something's always going to slip through.
Exactly. Right. People tell us, how can you have 800 accounts? You know, how can you control that and not be afraid that something horrible will happen? And we say, no, you know, we train our diplomats for 6-7 months. And we trust them with so many sensitive issues. We can also trust them to know what they're doing on Twitter and to know the boundaries of their activity. And it's working out. We have mistakes, but the overall we achieve much more than the mistakes, you know, could hurt us, at least at this point.
So I wanted to ask you about that. When you talk about achievement, so, you know, Lahav spoke about the video that came out after the stabbing at Damascus Gate within 2 hours. And yes, that was fairly quick. But we've seen other problems in the past, even during the recent operation in Gaza. There was the whole AP building. And I don't want to get into that whole story necessarily. But how do you measure achievement? Like, how do you measure success? Is it retweets on Twitter? Is it likes on Facebook? How do you know that if you did something digitally, it's actually changing the hearts and minds of people in a specific place?
Right. That's you know, the question that everybody's asking as far as online, working online. Sometimes it can be a campaign where we are targeting a certain audience and we see the analytics. Did they like it? Did they share it? Sometimes we want to reach specific individuals to make them reply to something. We do that. Other times we want to create stories in the traditional media. We say to our people, we must create 3 stories in each of your country, each of your countries. And we do it that way. And there are also anecdotal examples that are quite amazing. For example, we have Iranian officials that have responded to our posts on our Persian channels on Twitter. Mm-hmm. So the Iranian communications minister responded to our post last year. And that is a success because he realizes that he's leaving, you know, the ground open for us if he doesn't respond. And he knows we have literally millions of Iranians in Iran following our Persian channels. Another important example, you know, and during the last operation, the Iranian deputy foreign minister visited Vienna. And he posted a tweet saying he's shocked and horrified to see the flags of Israel on government buildings in Vienna. And we, our director general, Alon Ushpiz, answered him directly on Twitter, quote tweeted him, telling him that it's not surprising to see Israeli flags because Vienna, Austria is a fellow democracy that supports Israel. And we made a big deal of that tweet. We put it everywhere we could. And in the end, Zarif canceled his visit in Vienna over the flags. So sometimes you can amplify, you know, your position using social media and create real political changes on the ground as well.
Okay. And where, I guess right now, right, we're in a, I mean, there was a terrorist attack yesterday, but relatively we're in a calm time for Israel. But how do things shift when we're at war, when we're in a state of emergency? How do things operate then?
Well, I mean, I think we've gotten much better. During the last operation, we actually had a digital war room, so to speak, public diplomacy war room where the representatives of IDF, police, other relevant security organizations and others were actually at the ministry physically, dealing only with the public diplomacy aspect. So if we wanted something, whether it's footage or information, quickly those people were at hand. So that is happening much more quickly. I think, you know, people look at social media closely during times of conflict. It's true. But the main advantage actually is during the day-to-day. And the main advantage is vis-a-vis audiences that we can't reach in other ways. So our most successful channels out of all the languages are actually Persian and Arabic, because we are reaching audiences where Israel many times doesn't have diplomatic representation or people on the ground. And we see that people across the Gulf, across the Middle East, are eager, much more than ever, to hear from Israel. Just an example, our channels to the Gulf were created a few years ago, long before the Abraham Accords were signed. And so when they were signed, we already had contacts online, people to engage with that knew us. And that's something amazing. And that's why I think social media has so many more advantages than it does, you know, threats. And the threats, of course, are there as well.
How have the Abraham Accords changed anything for the digital diplomacy department?
Oh, look, they've changed everything, literally. We have people now that are openly, you know, speaking in Hebrew. Last week, we had a Twitter Spaces, I don't know if you saw, on the Israel account, on Hanukkah, together with top influencers from the UAE, who, you know, are expressing their thoughts about Hanukkah and the Jewish community there and that kind of thing. During the operation in Gaza, for the first time, we had people from the Gulf who were openly criticizing Hamas and saying, you know, actually, Israel is on the right here. And so that is something that we had never seen before either. And of course, the whole expo in Dubai that's happening right now, which is an amazing platform to show what Israel, you know, Israel's vision for the region. It's amazing what's happening, frankly, on Arabic. And yeah. If I look, I have a monthly report of the engagement and of the followers on all of my channels. And the Arabic and Persian make up more than 75%. And that's including Hebrew and Arabic and the other languages. And so that's amazing. That shows you the power of digital diplomacy, I think.
Yiftach, you mentioned the coordination with the IDF spokesperson and, you know, how it's much better today than it was in the past. I'm curious, though, you know, one of the things I've always thought about the PR issues that Israel faces, or Hasbara, as it's called, is that Israel, because of its government makeup, the fact that we are a parliamentary system, so every minister is not necessarily and is mostly not from the same party as the prime minister, and therefore feels an independence, unlike, let's say, the United States, where everyone serves at the pleasure of the president. People can say what they want. They don't necessarily have to follow messaging that's dictated from above. And let's call it a lack of discipline. I don't mean that as a in a derogatory way, but that lack of discipline is what leads to mixed messaging sometimes. And I'm curious if in recent years you feel that that's changed for the better, that people do want to be more coordinated, even in competing ministries and politicians who don't necessarily come from the same parties.
Yeah, I feel it's getting much better. I've been on this job for 3 years and before that, 4 years in London. I think coordination is better, certainly at the level of the people that I'm working with, at the professional level. I think the wider issue in Israel, and it's always been like that, it's not new, is that many strategic issues are viewed from a security perspective. And the foreign ministry is maybe the only ministry that is handling national security that has a civilian perspective. And an international perspective, and we are working hard to bring that perspective to the light, and with the strength that we believe it should get, and that's always been a challenge, and I think today everybody realizes that a war and conflict in Gaza is not just a kinetic conflict; it's a social media conflict, at least. As important, at least, and certainly in the long run, And I think this is something that's understood by everybody, but it's not necessarily acted upon with the strength that it should be. And our job is to push that narrative, to push that that viewpoint. And I think we are making headway in that mm-hmm. regard.
So I want to ask you something about a different topic. As someone who was in London, you said for 4 years, there's been a bunch of anti-Semitic incidents lately, and the most recent, I think we saw during Hanukkah, there was like a party bus of Jews and it sounded like Israelis from the video. Yeah. And some people on the street started, banging on the bus and cursing at them and chasing them. And I guess the question is and you were around, I think, for a lot of the Corbyn years as well, when there was the labor anti-Semitism scandal. What is Israel's role in dealing with these anti-Semitic incidents, waves that are happening in different major Jewish communities around the world?
Well, I think, first of all, Israel has a role in calling it out when it sees it. Israel is the Jewish state, after all, and we look at anti-Semitism very seriously when it happens in other countries. And I'll never forget, Mark Regev arrived, and on the first week he arrived, there was a big scandal regarding around Corbyn, and Mark went on the Andrew Marr show, which is the top, weekend news interview show. And Mark said, what we saw, there is no other name for it. He said it like that in a very diplomatic way, but the headlines the next day were very clear as to what happened in the labor in those times. So I think calling it out is something very important. We are not trying to, it's not our responsibility in the sense that every government must deal with anti-Semitism just like it must deal with other forms of racism and bigotry and incitement. We are not there to replace any government, but certainly to make our point known. And we do what we can, of course, behind the scenes to help.
So Yiftach, I was looking at your CV and I saw, with this, I guess we'll let you go, but I saw that you were deputy ambassador in Ethiopia. You were the head of public diplomacy in Argentina and Buenos Aires. We mentioned your spokesperson role in London. And before you became the head of digital diplomacy, apparently you were a commander on a scientific mission to Mars. Do you want to just explain to our listeners what exactly that is? Back in 2019, you were a D-Mars mission? What was that? And why were you there?
Well, I can talk about this for a whole podcast. So
so give us the short version.
I have a very keen interest in space, but in an amateur way. And I heard 2 years ago that there is an organization in Israel that's carrying out analog missions in the Ramon Crater because it's similar to Mars. An analog mission means that you take some people and you put them in a hub, in a place that is simulating a mission to Mars. And they go out of that place only with spacesuits, and they are completely isolated for a while. Our mission was 2 weeks. And I applied for this. I was the only non-scientist that applied. And my pitch to the guys at DMARS, that's the organization, was that, diplomats that are serving in missions far away from the home base are a bit like astronauts. They're far away from home base. They are in a new territory. They need to have very good interpersonal skills to manage a team. They need to, tackle problems on their own without guidance from the headquarters. And these guys bought my pitch and made me the commander of the mission. And it was incredible. We were at Ramon Crater for 2 weeks. No cell phone, no computers, nothing. Only a computer that is talking to the mission control with a 20-minute delay. So you send out something, you get back a message 20 minutes later. And it taught me a lot. It taught me about the need for humor, about the way, that you... But how can you manage and command a team of people, of six people, for 2 weeks, living in a very, very cramped space? And it made me appreciate what we do at the foreign ministry. We sometimes take for granted the people here at the ministry. But the skills it takes to be in a small embassy in Ethiopia are sometimes relevant also for for space exploration. Yeah.
Wow, that is really fascinating.
That is cool. So basically, a diplomat, if Israel ever has diplomatic relations with Mars, you will probably be the first candidate to be the ambassador. Right? I mean, like, I think...
I agree to sign up right now.
Well, if Yair Lapid is listening to this, then hopefully he'll make a mental note. Yiftach Kuriel, the head of the director of the Department for Digital Diplomacy at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, thank you very much for being with the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Next, we have the Jerusalem Post defense reporter, Anna Arenheim, to talk to us about what are Israel's military options when it comes to Iran.
So it's great to have with us Annie Arenheim, our Jerusalem Post military correspondent. And Annie, you've been closely following the talks that are taking place or were taking place in Vienna. They seem to have been stalled. No major progress has been going on or seen. But at the same time, we've seen a lot of saber rattling coming out of Jerusalem, coming out of Tel Aviv. President Isaac Herzog saying Israel will act alone by itself if it needs to when receiving the credentials of the new U.S. ambassador to Israel, Thomas Nides. We saw comments by Naftali Bennett, Yair Lapid, everyone, Benny Gantz, the defense minister, everyone. You know, it's actually interesting to see how they're all in the same kind of message and they're saying the same things. But a lot of saber rattling, and I'm wondering what you're hearing in the IDF. Like, are they preparing? Is there training? Is there procurement? Where do things stand right now on the military side of all of this?
Well, first off, thank you so much for having me. There's been a lot of saber rattling, and a lot of saber rattling for, you know, in the past year or two by the IDF that was never really too pleased with the deal, but was not pleased at all with leaving the deal, the nuclear deal. For many years, for the past 3 years, the IDF has not really had the ability to train as they wanted to procure the munition that they wanted to. And now with the budget, they've been able to say exactly, okay, these are the munitions we want, the precise munitions that we need. We're going to increase our training by 50%, I believe, for reservists, really focusing on the northern front, as well as focusing on the south. They know that there's always going to be Gaza involved in whatever war is going to break out in the north. And they're also being prepared for attacks coming from Jordan, from Iraq, from other countries. And so they're not only saber rattling, but they are really preparing for if push comes to shove, for the war after the attack, not only the attack itself, because, I mean, that is one story, but the real story is what's going to happen afterwards. The attack could take, you know, it's not going to be as easy as what happened in Syria and Iraq when Israel took out the nuclear reactors there. It's going to be much more complicated. Unlikely that Israel will be able to carry out a successful attack on its own. It will need help from the United States, but really they're preparing for what comes after. And I think that's something that's not really discussed that much.
So you said that there's been saber rattling for the past year or two in preparation, but it seems like there's a shift and a difference in what's being done in the past few months under this new government and with the new budget. So could you elaborate a bit on that?
I think it also has to do with the fact that the talks did restart, and Israel and the IDF really wants to show that even though they don't have someone sitting around that table in Vienna, they do have influence one way or another. And I think that Naftali Bennett, as prime minister, also wants to show that you can't walk all over him. He's no Bibi, but you can't walk all over him. And he has always been very hawkish on Iran. Even as defense minister, I remember him telling me and other reporters that under his term as defense minister, they were seeing a decrease in Iranian activity in Syria. So he has always been very active in pushing the defense establishment and the political echelon in Israel and abroad about the fact that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon and Israel will do what it takes in order to prevent that.
So we also know, though, that Israel had prepared military options back in 2010, 2012, back when Benjamin Netanyahu was the prime minister. They were never activated. They were never used. And after the 2015 nuclear deal, the JCPOA was reached, Israel kind of was against, of course, the deal, but kind of came to terms with the fact that there is going to be a deal now for a number of years. And therefore, it kind of threw its military option to the side. And in the years that since then, and I've heard this all from IDF officers, and I know you have as well, is it didn't keep up, it didn't like sharpen the knife all the time. It kind of neglected it. And as a result, where we are right now, in December of 2021, there is not a viable military option right now on the table. Now that there's a defense budget, the military is able to start once again to prepare for that. So the question is, you know, there's maybe two sides to this question. One is, what do those preparations look like in terms of training, right? And what's the focus in those trainings? And the second question, and the second side to this, and you touched upon this before, is can Israel do it, right? I mean, you mentioned Iraq and Syria. Those were single facilities above ground. Here we're talking about scattered facilities across a very large country, some of them deep underground, reinforced in bunkers. Can Israel get the job done?
I think that Israel needs help to get the job done. It needs a lot of training, not only for the Air Force, which is training constantly and as well as carrying out operations on a daily basis, but it needs its ground forces, its reserve troops, its elite units to also train. And like I said, it's focusing on the Northern Front. It's focusing on Hezbollah, but it needs to focus as well on militias from Syria, Hezbollah in Syria. I think that the Israeli military knows that, and it knows that this is something that they have not been able to do in recent years. Either they, you know, put it aside, saying, okay, we don't have the budget, so we won't focus on it. Or they just said, okay, well, it doesn't seem like the most imminent threat, and we have other threats that you know, need our attention. But this is something that I think in the past 2 years, the IDF has been talking a lot about preparing for Iran. So it's something that has returned to being the top focus. And when I talk about Iran, it's Iran and Hezbollah. Those two together. But like I said before, Israel does need help. They will not be able to carry out strikes in Iran. Like you said, these are facilities underground, facilities that have been allegedly attacked by Israel in the past and rebuilt by the Iranians. So this is something that it might not just be one strike. It might not be just two strikes, but it could be a wave of strikes with numerous aircraft. Something that in Syria, the Israeli Air Force has already changed the way that they carry out operations because of the air defenses that Iran brought into the country. So they know that they need to focus differently and carry out the attacks differently than they thought about in the past. Iran has really strong air defense systems. And the IDF and its pilots know that, and they've been training for that.
And another reason that people have said that Israel can't necessarily attack Iran in a way that would end its nuclear program is that Israel doesn't have the right weapons for it, the strong enough bunker busters or the planes that could carry those things. But you've been reporting that Israel has been trying to buy more things. So I guess what can you tell us about what Israel is buying and what they do in this context?
Well, Israel is buying a lot of precision munitions, but the munitions that they need to get in order to successfully destroy Iranian nuclear facilities are so heavy that our jets can't carry them. There have been tests by the Americans on F-35s and F-16s recently, but as it stands, our jets cannot carry the massive bunker busters that are required for such an operation. What I've heard is that they have asked the Americans for various types of munitions that could be used to carry out attacks like that, but the Americans are not ready to give Israel everything on its wish list.
You mentioned also the war that would ensue, right? Obviously, an attack is an attack, but then there's the war that comes after, and that would be a war with the Northern Front, right? And the IDF, they no longer look at Hezbollah as on its own and Syria on its own, but everyone is kind of, it won't be necessarily the third Lebanese war, it will be the first Northern War.
What will that war look like? What are the scenarios that they talk about?
Utter devastation.
Oh, that's really optimistic. Thank you for that, Annie. Really appreciate it.
I'm not the most optimistic person in the world. I'm more of a realist. But it's not only the first northern war, right? Like I said, they're going to be rockets also from the south, also from attacks from Iraq. Could even possibly see strikes coming from Yemen, right? There are Houthis in Yemen. The Houthis are Iranian proxies like Hezbollah. And the Houthis have been hitting and striking at Saudi Arabia for years. And this is something that is going to put the whole region into a massive war. There's going to be strikes across the country, precision munitions hitting strategic facilities in Israel, hundreds if not thousands of injuries and deaths. And it's not going to be a war like the May operation, where there were 4,000 rockets.
There were 4,000 rockets, and Iron Dome was able to handle all of them. I'll just add that something that I've always thought about an operation against Iran and against its nuclear facilities, what people need to realize, I think, is that, like what you mentioned, it's not one facility like Iraq, like Syria. And therefore, the damage that Israel can do, it can be extensive, let's say, and it can set it back. But it's only setting it back. It's not destroying a program. And where the Iranians are today... Right, exactly. You cannot destroy knowledge. And where the Iranians are today in terms of being almost a nuclear threshold country with an amount of enriched uranium that could already start to be enriched to military grade levels and suffice for a nuclear weapon, you could set them back and delay them. But then they'll rebuild it all and they'll have great legitimacy, not only internally and domestically in Iran, but also around the world. And then what are you going to do? You're going to keep on attacking every 2 years? And I think that's what makes this so complicated, right? Much more complicated than Iraq and Syria in that sense, that you have the diplomatic aspect here, which really makes it complex.
Yeah, and the thing is that the Iranians are very patient. Very, very patient. And they know that if they just keep on playing the diplomatic game, they can also work on their nuclear program. That's what they've been doing. And again, it's not only the nuclear program. It's everything else surrounding that. The ballistic missile program of theirs is also very worrisome. The regional hostility is also worrisome. And they can keep playing as long as they're sitting around the table and saying, okay, we are ready to talk. Let's negotiate. At the diplomats talk, the military men act, and they do what they want. And nobody is stopping the Iranians. And they know that, and they know that at the end of the day, patience wins. And that's what they're hoping. They're hoping that Israel is just going to be, like you said, they're going to say Israel has had enough. Israel's going to strike. Iran is going to get the legitimacy that they need, that they want. And then they're going to have their program, and they win. So, is it a lose-lose situation, a win-win situation? It
depends who you're asking.
Lahav, I think we're a little irresponsible because we should have put a disclaimer that this is not for the lighthearted, this conversation with Annie.
I will be honest, though. Like, when we're talking about this not being for the lighthearted, when I was reporting on politics up until almost 2 years ago now, Iran was scary. But now that I have to think about Iran, practically every day in my work, it is very depressing, right? It is there are greater minds than me working on this problem, but I don't see a way out of it. It is really a very difficult situation because they have run ahead so far in their program. They don't care about the sanctions, even when they were very heavy. They continue to be very heavy. The U.S. hasn't lifted the sanctions from the Trump era, and it just doesn't scare them. And so, I think you said this last week on the podcast, where countries that want nuclear weapons mostly end up getting them. And it does seem like we're heading in that direction, which is, a scary thought considering the continuing rhetoric coming from their leaders about, essentially wanting genocide against Israel.
The one thing, though, I will say, Annie, and I wonder what you think about this, and it kind of feeds into what Ehud Barak wrote in Yediot Ahronot this week. I don't know if you read that column where he basically said, Israel, tone it down, stop fighting with the Americans, realize you have to work with America, not against America. But I also think that, obviously it'll be a bad war. War is terrible, utter devastation, like you mentioned. But Israel still is
the most powerful country, not only in the Middle East, but also far and beyond, right? And yes, war is terrible, but I don't think that we also need to be careful not to talk about something like the end of Israel. And I know you didn't say that, so I'm not putting words into your mouth, but I think that we do have to recognize that Israel, it'll be bad. People, lives will be lost. Destruction will occur. But Israel has a powerful military. We have ways to defend ourselves and to attack our enemies.
We do. And I don't think it's going to be the end of Israel. Far from it. It's going to be a really hard hit. But many countries have gone through destructive wars. Look at World War II in Europe. But they recovered. And look what we have now. I think it's a very, very scary scenario. But that's the way the world has been from the beginning of time. There's been wars between tribes, between countries, between nations. And this is something that, yes, it's scary. It's terrifying. But that's the reality.
Well, Annie, great to have you on the show, always, for your insight. And we will continue to enjoy reading your articles and scaring us and the rest of our readers.
I hope I'm not too scared with my articles. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. If you enjoyed this week's episode, please send it to your friends and family. We're available on all major podcast platforms, and we will be back next week.